So tonight, I'd like to talk about awareness or knowing or mindfulness or consciousness or non-dual perception. We have kind of a problem with language on this kind of conceptualization, and I'll talk more about that later. And I'm kind of concerned about this because it's a huge topic. And it touches on enlightenment, it touches on jhana practice, mindfulness, pretty much everything else. So I have to sort of stay fairly limited, and I'll try to keep it, in Marin Sangha, we focus on practice in daily life. And so I will try to keep on coming back to that, on how we can treat this entity or these entities in a way that helps us in our daily practice. So first, though, the nice thing about talking about this is it gives me a chance to do a reading of a well-known sutta, a well-known discourse of the Buddha's called Advice to Bahiya. And you've probably heard this before, but I wanted to add some backstory that I ran into recently. The backstory, which I found online, I had actually heard this, but I did find it online, so I got some more detail. So first of all, this guy, Bahiya, was born at a place called Bahiya. So really, Bahiya is just what they call a toponym, a place name used as a personal name. And he's also known by his nickname, Daru Chiriya, I'm probably mispronouncing that, which means the bark clad. We'll find out why in a little while as I go into the story. So Bahiya became a trader, and he sailed the high seas as a merchant. Seven times he sailed down the Indus River to distant lands and returned home safely. But on the eighth journey, while on his way to Southeast Asia, he was shipwrecked and floating on a plank was washed ashore near Suparaka, an ancient port located near modern Mumbai on the west coast of India. So he lost all his clothes in the storm. He's washed ashore, stark naked, and he finds that he's not far away from this town, a port. So he doesn't want to walk in town and ask for help, stark naked. So he finds some tree bark and puts it on as sort of a tunic. Now, I don't know what kind of tree bark lends itself to this, but I guess some does, and he found the tree bark that was appropriate, and he made himself sort of a bark tunic. And he goes into town, and so he sort of begged for help, and the people there, seeing his bark dress and his calm demeanor, decided that he must be some kind of holy ascetic. And it turns out that wearing bark clothing was something that ascetics did back then. And mendicant orders were pretty common. So they just assumed that this guy was some wandering holy man. So they gave him food, and they gave him shelter, and they gave him some clothes to wear, although he stuck with the bark. And he refused all the luxuries that were offered to him, which just enhanced the whole thing about him being a holy man. So his fame grew. And people became his followers and came to listen to him talk. And so he sort of goes, this is kind of working for me. And so he stayed on doing this. And on account of his clothing, he was called Daru Chiriya, the bark clad. So let's go on to the sutta. The sutta is in Udana. The Udana, and it's 1.10, and I have edited it. It's relatively short as a sutta, but it's still long. I have heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying near Savatthi at Jetta's Grove. And on that occasion, Bahiya of the bark cloth was living in Suparaka by the seashore. He was worshipped, revered, honored, venerated, and given homage. A recipient of robes, alms, food, lodgings, and medicinal requisites for the sick. Then, when he was alone in seclusion, this line of thinking occurred to him. Now, of those in this world, who are arahants, that is enlightened, who are arahants or have entered the path of arahantship? Am I one? Then a devata. And a devata, it's fairly complicated. The simplest thing to say is that a devata is sort of a semi-magical being. A devata who had once been a blood relative in a previous life of Bahia of the bark cloth, compassionate, desiring his welfare, knowing with her own awareness the line of thinking that had arisen in his awareness, went to him and on arrival said to him, "You, Bahia, are neither an arahant, nor have you entered the path of arahantship. You don't even have the practice whereby you could become an arahant or enter the path of arahantship." Oh, snap. So he's kind of abashed and he says, "Then who in this world are arahants or have entered the path to arahantship?" So she says, "Bahia, there is a city in the northern country named Savatthi. There the Blessed One, an arahant, rightly self-awakened, is living now. He truly is an arahant and teaches the Dhamma leading to arahantship." Then Bahia, deeply chastened by the devata, left Suparaka right then, and in the space of one night, went all the way to where the Blessed was staying near Savatthi at Jetta's Grove. Now, we got to take this with a grain of salt, because that's a distance of about 1,200 miles. So either the timeline is off, or he flew on a UFO or something. Anyway, so he ends up at Savatthi. Now, on that occasion, a large number of monks were doing walking meditation in the open air. He went to them and on arrival said, "Where, venerable sirs, is the Blessed One now staying? We want to see him, the arahant, rightly self-awakened. The Blessed One has gone into town for alms." Then Bahia, hurriedly leaving Jetta's Grove and entering Savatthi, saw the Blessed One going for alms in Savatthi. Seeing him, he approached the Blessed One and on reaching him, threw himself down with his head at the Blessed One's feet and said, "Teach me the Dhamma, O Blessed One. Teach me the Dhamma, O one well gone, that will be for my long-term welfare and bliss." A second time, Bahia said to the Blessed when this was said, the Blessed One said to him, "This is not the time, Bahia. We have entered the town for alms." A second time, Bahia said to the Blessed One, "But it is hard to know for sure what dangers there may be for the Blessed One's life or what dangers there may be for mine. Teach me the Dhamma, O Blessed One. Teach me the Dhamma, O one well gone, that will be for my long-term welfare and bliss." A second time, the Blessed One said, "This is not the time, Bahia." So the Bahia, of course, pleaded for a third time. And there's a magic thing for that you hear a lot in ancient scripture, that three requests are to be honored. So the third time, Bahia pleaded, and then the Buddha said, "Then Bahia, you should train yourself thus." Now we get to the good stuff. "In reference to the seen, there will only be the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then, Bahia, there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder, nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of stress." Through hearing this brief explanation of the Dhamma from the Blessed One, the mind of Bahia of the bark cloth right then and there was released. The Blessed One left. Now, not long after the Blessed One's departure, Bahia was attacked and killed by a cow with a young calf. The monks went to the Blessed One. They said to him, Bahia's body has been cremated, Lord. What is his destination? What is his future state? Monks, Bahia of the bark cloth was wise. He practiced the Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma and did not pester me with issues related to the Dhamma. Bahia of the bark cloth monks is totally unbound. Then on realizing the significance of that, the Blessed One on that occasion exclaimed, where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing, there the stars don't shine, the sun isn't visible. There the moon doesn't appear, there darkness is not found. And when a sage, a Brahman through sagacity, has realized this for himself, then from form and formless, from bliss and pain, he is freed. So the Buddha is talking about an experience where there is no self involved in perception. Some people call this non-dual awareness, where there's no subject and object, where there is no distance between what is seen and what is doing the seeing, which seems like a pretty major stretch for most of us. But is this enlightenment? There's a lot of there's a lot of argument about this. In Dzogchen, for instance, it is believed that this pure awareness, non-dual awareness, is indeed enlightenment. Much of Zen agrees with this. In Zen, there's this whole thing about the mind is like a mirror with but a bit of dust on it. And if you can remove the dust, not as easy as it sounds, you achieve this absolute clarity of the mirror. But other lineages say that no, this too is just conditioned phenomena. Itself is just impermanent, like all other phenomena. The Buddha, by the way, says that all phenomena are impermanent and illusory except Nibbana. So what is Nibbana? Nibbana is also called the deathless, meaning permanent and unchanging. By the way, there's a great book it's called The Island, and it's by Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro. And it's a treatment of the issue of what is enlightenment. And it's a big book, because the Buddha said a lot of things about enlightenment, mostly in terms of what it wasn't, not what it was. In fact, I think at one point he says, whatever you think it is other than that. So non-dual awareness, I mean, the thing about non-dual awareness and it being enlightenment or not being enlightenment is that for most people, the experience of non-dual awareness is not permanent. It's temporary. And it can be actually dangerous. Ajahn Sumedho has talked about an experience he had that he called later on false enlightenment. He actually felt that he had reached Nibbana. And for about 6 months, he was in a state of sublime bliss. And then it gradually slipped away, to be replaced by this fury and deep frustration that he had had this experience and then lost it. But he talks about this and gives it as sort of a lesson in humility. And I think that other people have experienced false enlightenment and with much more damaging results. I think some of the gurus who have behaved badly have done so because they've had this experience of false enlightenment and taken it far more seriously than it should have been. But if the Buddha was in a permanent state of non-dual awareness, how could he function? If there's nothing in the seeing but the seen, how does one make sense of one's experience? It's hard to imagine driving a car or balancing a checkbook if you are really in a state of non-dual awareness. And the Buddha administered a huge complex of monastic communities and a broad proselytizing program And he was making up rules as they went along. I mean, the Buddha clearly was able to participate in a lot of very complex behavior. So anyway, this is just something to consider. I'm not going to weigh in on whether non-dual awareness is enlightenment or permanent non-dual awareness is enlightenment or not. I'll just leave that as a question for you to consider. Many of us, some of us here in this virtual room, have had experiences where there is at least less self, where the self, as Donald Rothberg says, becomes thinner. And this can be an exhilarating experience. It can be sublime or it can be scary. I had an experience many years ago, about 18 years ago, on a long retreat where I was doing enough concentration practice that at one point my sense of self was, in retrospect, seemed to be slipping away. I started, like, the visual experiences and the sound experiences became so intense, and there wasn't any sort of personality mediating between me and the experience. And I became anxious. I sort of freaked out. So my first response was to sort of muscle my way back to normalcy, to sort of say, hey, I'm not some umi-gumi kind of guy. I drink beer. I watch football. I'm not susceptible to this kind of stuff. Anyway, this was not a good move on my part. It was a real lost opportunity. Mindfulness would have been a much better way of dealing with it, of looking at how it felt in the body, for instance, of asking myself questions about how this was manifesting rather than just freaking out. So one of the things that I learned from this is something that I had heard before, and that is that the personality is afraid of being left behind. The personality doesn't like it when the self gets thin. The personality is like a dog when your car keys jingle. It doesn't want to be left behind. It wants to go for the ride. Ajahn Sumedho has said, the personality never becomes enlightened. But it's clear that the personality doesn't really go away either. So the personality doesn't really have that much to fear. I think, you know, the Buddha clearly had a personality. When you read his discourses, you get a sense of somebody who has a personality and yet is apparently enlightened. For all intents and purposes, I'm prepared to call him enlightened. Other people certainly have, but he clearly had a personality. So going back to my experience of when myself got thinner and I kind of freaked out about it, my experience would have been a lot better if I had had a friendly attitude towards my experience. Concentration practice can be so dry that, it doesn't have to be, by the way, but it can be so dry that it's very easy to go one way or the other about whether or not the experience of the thinning self is pleasant or unpleasant. So I think... having a friendly attitude is really important. And there are a couple of different ways of helping to cultivate that. One is work on metta practice. Another one, which I think is helpful for metta practice and also just helpful as a basic way of encouraging friendliness towards one's experience, is gratitude. Gratitude practice. Just happy to be here. Happy to breathe. Happy to be able to practice the Dhamma. Happiness to have known love. Happiness to be loved. And I think this is actually pretty important because I was thinking about this when I was writing my notes for this. And I remembered there was a guy who used to come to Sangha quite often in the very early days when we were back at Turtle Rock. And on a long retreat, he had an experience that when he described it to me, it sounded very much like this non-dual awareness, for want of a better description. He said it was almost as if what he was seeing was being projected on the back of his skull. And he freaked out. He had deep anxiety and depression. And therapy did not help him. He finally gave up meditation, gave up Buddhism entirely. I don't think he ever entirely recovered from this experience. So it's something that I think could have been entirely different if he had approached this with a different attitude towards his experience. So we can talk about pure awareness, where only what is seen is what is seen, what is heard is what is heard. But how do we understand? How do we come to understand awareness? This is a practice or a set of practices in which we can examine awareness or use awareness in our other practices. Now, I mentioned earlier, there's all kinds of language problems. There's a vocabulary problem. Words like awareness, consciousness, knowing, attention, and others are often used interchangeably. We were at an awareness retreat last year, and there they used a taxonomy that distinguished that awareness is simply a capacity, irrespective of content, and consciousness is awareness when it has an object. That is, one is conscious of something. You're conscious of the breath, conscious of a thought. Okay, so that's useful. But they had all kinds of really good quotes from various teachers and from the discourses. But they kept having to say, they'd read them aloud and then say, she's using the word knowing in a way that we would normally use as consciousness. And so they had to keep on using these disclaimers over and over again because people were using these words in different ways. So my attitude is, don't get too hung up on the language, just read it and have some kind of appreciation, at least for the approach, for the attitude being taken about this practice. So on retreat, the practice being taught was awareness of awareness, or more appropriately, using their taxonomy, attention on consciousness. Well, I like awareness of awareness better. It has more of a ring to it. And this is kind of a paradox, trying to become aware of awareness, which sounds sort of like trying to read the brand name of the batteries in your flashlight in a dark room. So teachers, there are a number of teachers who teach this, Donald Rothberg, Philip Moffitt, Sally Ann Guy Armstrong, our own Don Scott, and others. And the general approach is to start with a very strong samatha practice or concentration practice, because the mind needs to be fairly steady before trying to place attention on awareness. I'm going to read something written by Philip Moffitt about this. Consciousness through concentration can lead to a very contented mind. It is skillful to start to notice when contentment of mind starts to arise. The mind becomes less interested in the objects arising in the mind, and even less interested in conceptual thinking. At some point, a mind state may arise where the only knower is consciousness, and the object or what is being known is the capacity of consciousness itself. Thus, the nature of consciousness in and of itself can be explored. This is sometimes referred to as exploring the nature of mind. It's a fairly densely packed little bit of advice, and I'm not going to try to reread it because my tongue's getting dry. Now, there are a number of techniques for how to turn the attention to awareness itself. On this retreat, for instance, Guy Armstrong listed 14 specific practices. Donald has one or two others. I've found only one or two helpful for me. Some of them sounded silly. Some of them sounded very interesting, but really didn't work for me. For me, what worked was to allow the awareness to be in the background. We often talk in giving meditation practice guidelines about foreground and background. So for instance, in concentration practice, a really effective way for many people and for me is to put the breath in the foreground and just allow other things to be in the background, not trying to make other phenomena go away. When I first started practicing, I really tried to grab onto the breath and make everything else go away, just to focus in so narrowly on the breath. And all that did was create a lot of struggle, a lot of conflict. I found that it was much more relaxing and much more effective to just allow all the other stuff to take place. Thoughts, sounds, physical sensations, as long as I could keep the breath in the foreground and allow everything else to be in the background, this was an effective meditation practice for me, and it works out for many other people as well. It's relaxed attention, and relaxed attention is a hugely effective way of meditating, of developing that unification of mind. So on this retreat, following Donald's advice, what I did was I'd start off that way, and eventually I'd get so settled that I could let the awareness be in the background and be all of the other phenomena be in the foreground, breath and everything else. And then, what I would do is let the awareness be in the foreground and everything else be in the background, just letting that shift. And it sounds like, what's he talking about? But it worked very effectively for me. And I found that because I had been cultivating a friendly attitude, it was really a lovely experience. And of course, the personality did not go away. I did not achieve any kind of non-dual awareness, but the self did get thinner, and it was a wonderful experience. But I said I was going to focus on practicing daily life, and I'm going to get to that. Many of us don't have the opportunity to go on long retreats, and many retreats are not really conducive to this kind of practice. By the way, there is another awareness retreat coming up at Spirit Rock. I would recommend getting into it. The retreat we went on was 3 weeks long, which was very helpful. It really gave an opportunity for experimentation. This upcoming retreat is shorter, so you don't get as much of an opportunity to play around with the brain. So the effect of turning attention to awareness like that can actually be kind of shocking. My brother tells a story about he remembers when he was little going to use the bathroom on a train, and when he hit the lever to flush, all that happened is the bottom of the toilet opens up and you look down and you see the tracks. And he was a kid. He was quite shocked when he saw that, you know, that's what happens to, you know, your poop and your waste on a train. It just goes out on the track. That's why those signs that you see in the bathrooms of a train say, please don't flush the toilet while the train is in the station. They don't want that anyway. So, he's half brother, actually. He has quite a practice himself, and he likens that to certain experiences that he's had in Zen practice of having these flashes of where there's much less self and much more of just pure perception. So in this experience that I had, the experience that I had was ecstatic. But again, I had developed a friendly attitude towards my experience. So the context was pleasant. So let's talk about practice in daily life, because we can't always be on retreat. And even if we have a great retreat, we still have to return to the normal world. You know, I did have a great retreat, and I had to go back to being a jerk as I usually am. I had to, you know, come back to, you know, the usual bad habits that I have at home. So there's a couple of things I think that lend themselves to practice around the topic of awareness. And one of them is resting in awareness. Now, this is actually a lot like vanilla mindfulness, you know, being close to your actual experience rather than being wrapped up in your thoughts about your narration about what you're seeing. We spend a lot of time not actually seeing what's in front of us, but instead sort of filtering it through our past experience and through our narrative. Okay, so you're probably all aware of that. So this is a lot like awareness, vanilla mindfulness, but it's articulated differently, which can create a different context. This is sort of resting back in that sense of awareness rather than being caught up in our thinking about what is in front of us. So again, it's just a different way of looking at it. And it might not be any different for you than mindfulness practice, but articulating things differently can sometimes help you approach it in an entirely different way. And you may not be able to truly move into pure awareness, but you can hold the aspiration. And even an intellectual concept of awareness can help bring calm. Which leads me to the next form of practice, which is seeing awareness as the container, as a container for our experience. I have often found it helpful to remember that awareness itself does not suffer. You can be suffering physical and emotional pain, but the awareness itself is not suffering. Suffering is an event or a set of events that happens within a much larger context of awareness. The first arrow is about the body and about the emotions, which are fundamentally of the body. And the second arrow is of the mind. And all of that second arrow takes place within this larger context of awareness. It's like that saying, awareness is like the sky. Everything else is just weather. These may be intellectual realizations, but reflection is still a powerful tool in our practice, one that the Buddha included in his instructions, by the way. The idea of contemplation shows up over and over again in the discourses. So those are the two elements that I've or categories that I find particularly useful, the resting in awareness and seeing awareness as the container and knowing that awareness is a much vaster space than any of the things that occur within it. One other area for you to consider. According to the Buddha, Nibbana, as I said earlier, is deathless and unchanging and permanent. So is awareness deathless and unchanging? I want to read something here. I know I can find it. This is from Ajahn Mahabhuwa. There is no escaping the truth. Whatever arises has to vanish. Whatever is true, whatever is a natural principle in and of itself won't vanish. In other words, the pure mind won't vanish. Everything of every sort may vanish, but that which knows they're vanishing doesn't vanish. This vanishes, that vanishes, but the one that knows they're vanishing doesn't vanish. Well, you know what his opinion is. Awareness itself does not suffer and is the context in which all the other perceptual phenomena occur. So there's the question is, does awareness, is awareness permanent? Does awareness go away when you die? Is it my awareness or is it the awareness? I'm just going to leave that as a thread of inquiry for you. So we have plenty of time for questions, comments. As you know, there are a lot of topics there that I touched on very lightly. So lots of opportunity for us to drill down on stuff that I just touched on. Patty. Patty, oh, there you go.
I got it. Thank you. Everyone moves around on the screen and I couldn't find myself to unmute myself. thank you for that. I use that concept of awareness is bigger than whatever we're aware of. When I have physical pain, I try to establish my awareness of the sensations and I try to rest in the awareness instead of resting in the sensations. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. But I always go back to it. I have a question for you about something you read. The last quote you read, you said there. I can't remember the quote, but I want to make sure it was spelled T-H-E-I-R and not T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E. See, everyone just moved around again. I lost it.
Oh, yeah, I know. It does that. There's also a mute button in the lower left corner of the whole panel's screen. So, but yes, it says there is no escaping the truth.
No, not that there. It was about the person or the thing knowing awareness.
In the quote that I read?
Yeah, there was a quote you read about.
Okay, right. Okay. Everything of every sort may vanish, but that which knows knows of their vanishing, T-H-E-I-R, that is the knows the vanishing of the every sort of things that arise and vanish.
Can you read that one more time, please?
Okay. Everything of every sort may vanish, but that which knows the vanishing of everything doesn't vanish. This vanishes, that vanishes, but the one that knows the vanishing doesn't vanish.
Thank you. I'm glad those were those and not theirs. Okay.
Well, I changed the there to the at one spot and it had exactly the same sense and was clear. It's one of those things that I guess is clear when you read it and you can see what the word is. These homonyms are confusing.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Bowman, you had your hand up.
Yes, thanks, Bill. That was a great talk. So I wanted to ask, is the non-dual awareness, is that the same as awakened awareness that I hear so much about? Mm-hmm.
Well, that would also be, I'm sure, cause for a lot of argument. It could be, as I said, some people say that it is enlightenment. Some people say that, no, it's just more conditioned phenomena that arises and passes. So
awakened awareness is?
It's that non-dual awareness is. Uh-huh. Awakened awareness is, I think, a slightly vaguer term. So it would depend on who was using the term and what they meant by it. So I don't really have an answer for you.
Hmm. Okay.
Sorry.
No, that's quite all right. I'll continue to seek an answer.
And there are some aspects of this that are really unanswerable, that yeah. are either dependent on different people's opinions or dependent on the context.
I know that Donald speaks about awakened awareness. And so I'm just starting to delve into it and was wondering if the non-dual awareness was?
Well, I would suspect that it's partly non-dual awareness, but partly in an engaged way in the world.
Yes.
So I know that he talks about the Bodhisattva principle. So I think that with Donald, and I may be putting words in his mouth, is that it's in a rather broader context, which raises all kinds of other interesting questions, which I'm not even going to try to go into here, but this would be a great question for Donald.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll bring it up to him. And thank you very much. It was a great talk and really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Bowman. So Barbara, your hand is up. And you're muted.
Yes, I'm unmuting. Yeah, I'm curious about the whole idea of what Philip talks about, the felt experience of awareness. Because when I lots of times try to intend to, you know, sort of enter into that felt experience, there's something visceral there. And I was wondering if you could talk any more about the visceral feeling, as well as the relationship between awareness and love, which I also see a kind of a visceral bodily aspect.
All right, that's a good question. And I think that's going to be different for different people. I found that when I, for me, the experience of having a fairly thin self and really having a sense of being aware of awareness, it was like an electric current was running through my body. And it could have been a terrifying experience. It was instead an ecstatic experience. And I think it was because I had started off with a friendly attitude towards my experience. I had been cultivating this positive attitude. So I think that's, for me, what was the felt sense of awareness of the awareness. I think love would be a lot about the context. For me, there was a sense of eros with the universe. Love would be almost too trivial a term for it. But yes, felt that that the universe was a fundamentally benign place to be. If I could experience stuff like this, it must mean that that I am meant to be here in this universe, which makes sense. You know, I evolved to be here, right? You know, if I was plopped down on Mars, it would not be a very pleasant experience because I was not evolved to be there. So does that help?
Yeah, it does. It is one of those kind of amorphous problems that I, you know, that because it does sound like it was a bodily experience for you, which then what if it's of the body, can we talk about it without the body? You know, if once the body dies, which the body does, then what happens to the awareness?
Well, remember, this is the experience of awareness of the awareness, not of the
right.
awareness
not
itself.
Of the awareness.
Right, yeah. Right. So this is sort of my reaction to having a relationship with awareness would be the best way I could put it. Mm-hmm. So the awareness itself didn't give a damn. The awareness itself is I think, and I'm glad you brought this up because I think maybe a better way that I should have put this is that you have a friendly attitude towards your relationship with awareness, because awareness itself doesn't suffer, but it also doesn't feel good or bad. The awareness itself is simply a vast space in which these other events take place. And but you can have a scary relationship with that concept of awareness, with the awareness, or you can have a beneficent one. And I think my practice was far long enough that I knew how to approach it with an attitude that would be a pleasant one rather than a scary one.
That helps. Thank you.
So, Nancy, your hand was up.
So, Bill, I appreciate your talk, and Barbara, what you just said was helpful too. When I was in the DPP, I had been on one of the retreats for several days, so my mind was fairly concentrated. And the instruction, Sally Armstrong was teaching, the instruction was, to observe the origin of a thought. So I had a task to occupy my mind. And I, too, slipped into a very similar experience that you're describing, Bill, the most ecstatic experience of my life. And what, and as you described it, I kind of get that kind of sense of it again. Barbara, when you said the felt sense of awareness, what I realized is that we are awareness. That is who and what we are. When people say, who are you? I finally knew the answer to that question, not as a concept, but as a direct experience. Now, it that experience faded, and I chased it for years, trying to find, you know, different instructions, ways to get back there. And I never did have that experience again. Yeah. And I also realized that it doesn't matter. What really matters, even though I'm still a little attached to it, and it did give me a sense of what you're talking about and what you just said, Barbara, that felt sense of awareness. But what really matters is how you live your life every day. And that's what really matters. So.
Yes. Thank you for that. Yeah, I think the thing about these wonderful experiences is we have such a tendency to chase after them. I'm going on another, on this other awareness retreat. And I know that I'm going to try doing this stuff again, even though I know in advance it's not going to work. You know, right. We do that. Right. We have these habits, and it's a very natural response. And that's been true, I think, of all the really ecstatic experiences I've had in meditation, is that I've tried to replicate them and I have failed to do so. All the great experiences have been by surprise, not by planning. So, and every time I have tried to replicate these experiences, it's just led to conflict. It's just led to dukkha. So that's a great lesson there, isn't it?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. So Mary, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Bill. This was really good. And I was on the awareness retreat this past time with you, and I'm actually pretty sure I'm gonna be on the one that's coming up too. Two things I want to say is right now our book group is reading the book Emptiness by Gary Armstrong. And I really recommend it because the whole idea of a thin self is captured really beautifully in this book. I'm sure you've probably read it, but
I haven't read it yet. It's on my stack. And
I got to say, it is a wonderful, wonderful book. It really is. And so much of what you talked about, is covered in this book. And he was one of the teachers on the retreat. Mm-hmm. So it's been very, very helpful because you can watch yourself. At least I watch myself getting in the way of stuff, you know, instead of having the experience, I'm having the narrative about the experience, which is a totally different thing, you know, and the part about awareness to me that I thought that was really intriguing is just the whole idea of we were practicing awareness. And then he had us being aware of our consciousness. And I remember that experience of that it is something that it doesn't have, it's boundless, it's deathless. And there's like these, that little touch of that place. And Patty, what you were talking about, it's not something I can sustain, but it is a place where there isn't pain there. You know, you have a sense of stuff arising, but all the dukkha stuff, it doesn't stick there at all. And so it's just a really, the more moments of clarity that I can have, the less less dukkha in my daily life I can have, which is a really good thing. I mean, a lot of times it's just like it's like when I used to play music, Mira, get out of your way. When I'm drawing, get out of your way. It's so much like that. And the book by Guy Armstrong on emptiness is really talking about getting out of your way, which is great. So thank you so much for this talk, Bill. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Guy is a terrific teacher. I'm looking forward to reading the book.